I next met with Dr. Jorge Cortez, and to begin, we chatted about a disease that exploded into attention at the last ASCO meeting, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and specifically two fascinating agents, the bispecific antibody blinatumomab and the antibody drug conjugate inotuzumab azogamycin.
There's been a lot of interest in monoclonal antibodies in ALL. Inotuzumab azogamycin, it's an immunoconjugate that targets CD22. The antibody is an anti-CD22 monoclonal antibody and attached to a toxin, which is calicheamycin. CD22 is expressed very frequently in ALL. In our experience, over 90% of the patients. So that's important because it applies then to a large percentage of patients. And this toxin is a very effective toxin. You may remember we have this drug in AML that was called gemtuzumab azogamycin, and that drug recently was taken out of the market, but we knew it was an effective drug. It was CD33 attached to calicheamycin. So it's the same toxin as that drug. And these studies have shown that in the setting of patients who have failed all the therapies, we have a very high response rate. We're getting up, you know, more than 50% of patients at least clearing their bone marrows and things like that. And these are patients that have been, some of them have failed two or three prior therapies. And this is single agent treatment that we're talking about. So we are very impressed with this drug. Of course, it's still investigational, but we think that it has the potential to very soon become FDA approved. Those studies have to be done, of course, but I think it will happen soon. And it has the ability to even by itself get remissions. I'll just mention briefly side effects, because just like that gemtuzumab azogamycin used to have a little bit of liver toxicity, we do see the same thing in a few patients here. It's very seldom serious. We also see some link between the liver toxicity and patients who receive a transplant shortly after the treatment, but it also seems to be related to what kind of conditioning regimen you use for the transplant. So other than that, a fairly clean drug.
How many patients did you report on, and what were their ages? Was this children, adults, both?
No, these were all adults in this study. It's a predominantly adult series. So the study is still ongoing, so we now have, you know, more patients. We've treated about 50 patients now in this study. But it is definitely something that could be exported to children as well. I don't see the reason why they wouldn't respond as well.
Any other cancers where CD22s overexpressed that this is being thought about?
Yes, lymphomas. There's been some work already in some non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and actually the initial study was done in non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and it definitely works also in non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. So that's also being investigated there. So many lymphoproliferative neoplasias could benefit from this drug.
And what's happening in terms of new clinical trials with this agent? I'm assuming it's being looked at up front or thought about?
That is correct. So one of the questions is, can you combine it with more of the standard chemotherapy, both up front and perhaps in salvage? So those clinical trials are starting to explore these combinations. And, you know, I think you can either combine them concomitantly with the chemotherapy or sequentially, meaning giving one cycle of chemotherapy, follow that with one cycle of the antibody and alternate them in such a way. Both of these strategies are being investigated.
Now, I'm assuming, guessing that the responses that are seen are clinically meaningful. You've had patients who had prolonged responses in a situation where they weren't doing well?
Absolutely. They're clinically meaningful in two ways. One is some patients are responding and they're holding the responses for quite a while by themselves. It's also meaningful in that some of these patients you are able to take to transplant, which offers additionally the potential cure, not with the antibody alone, but also having that ability to take the patients to transplant is a good thing.
The other agent that was presented at ASCO, I was also fascinated by, I think it's called blinatumomab.
Yes, this is a very interesting molecule. This is a bispecific immunotherapy that's called BiTE, which is an antibody that binds CD19 with CD3. And the concept is that you bring the CD19 expressing cells, the leukemia, the ALL cells, next to the CD3, the T cells. So it's essentially trying to get the patient's own T cells to try to kill the leukemia cells. So there's no toxin in this compound, and very different mechanism of action, although still based on the monoclonal antibody concept. And it's been very useful as well. The initial study that was done in Germany, They looked at patients that had responded to treatment with standard chemotherapy, but they had minimal residual disease detectable by flow cytometry or something like that. And they found that there was a very high response rate, meaning elimination of that minimal residual disease, and at a very high rate. So then the ongoing study, the one that was presented at ASCO, looked at patients that had active disease, and they gave this antibody. And again, it is very active. You see a high response rate, at least clearing of the bone marrow, some of them actually true complete remissions. And again, over 50% of patients responded, and some of them very heavily pretreated. So we see two different strategies, one with minimal residual disease, one with active disease with this agent, both of them showing the potential impact of this drug.
It is a monoclonal antibody, right?
It is a bispecific monoclonal antibody.
So it's like two kind of fused or something?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you think about this, an antibody looks like a letter Y. So you have two bound by their tail so that they bring whatever they connect to, they bring those cells together. So that's exactly what it is.
Let's talk a little bit about CML. And I want to ask you about a paper you had in the JCO, not only response, but early response to tyrosine kinase inhibitors in chronic myeloid leukemia. What was the point you were trying to make there?
Well, as we've improved our therapy for CML, we are getting more ambitious. And what we want is not just to see a response, but we want these responses to be durable and patients to be alive and well, not only in 5 years, but in 20 or 30 or 40 years. And what we've learned, and this has been around for a while, but it's starting to catch up more attention now, is the fact that the patients who respond early have a benefit over patients who may respond but take longer time to respond. You may remember that for many years, we were advocating the use of higher doses of imatinib, and one of the benefits was that you would get the responses much faster. There's issues with side effects and whatever, but just talking about the timing of response. And what's become very evident is that at 3 months, the patients that have the best response already at 3 months, either by cytogenetics or by molecular testing that have gone below a certain threshold, those are the patients who are more likely to have a good outcome in the long term, less of a chance of eventually relapsing. So that's what I wanted to emphasize in that article, saying it's good that you respond, but it's even better if you respond very early. That gives you a better chance that it's a predictor of a durable response and good survival.
So maybe you can sort of just outline your basic algorithm for monitoring response in CML and how it affects what you do. And also, I mean, I'm going to guess that you're using second-generation TKIs, nilotinib and dasatinib when you can.
Absolutely. So in terms of the monitoring algorithm, during the first year, I think that the critical time points are, of course, at baseline, you need to do absolutely unquestionable a bone marrow aspiration because you want to make sure that you stage your patient properly and all of that. And then critical time points are at 3 months from the start of treatment, 6 months from the start of treatment, and 12 months from the start of treatment. At those time points, it's important to do a cytogenetic analysis, at least by FISH. I prefer cytogenetics by conventional karyotype, but at the very least a FISH and a PCR to determine what kind of response these patients are having. Once the patient has a very stable, good response, that you know that there's a complete cytogenetic response, major molecular response, then the monitoring can be every 6 months, and that stays like that forever. But I think those 3 and 6 months at the beginning are very, very critical. You asked about the use of the second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I do use them in all my patients as initial therapy. I think, in general, they offer a better outcome than imatinib. However, there's no question that imatinib is a good drug. There are many settings where imatinib is what you have to use, and imatinib is becoming generic soon, so there may have some benefits in that regard. So that's where this early monitoring becomes very critical, because perhaps by identifying at 3 months the patients who are doing great, you don't have to worry about the second generation TKIs, and those patients are predicted to be doing well in the long term. And then capture at that point those who are not doing as well. Now, we still have to establish whether switching at that point will improve their outcome, but at least it's a way of trying to rationalize these strategies.
And what about patients who are started on nilotinib and dasatinib, what kind of results would get you to change treatment?
Well, that's a very good question and a bit of a tricky one, because there are two parts of my answer to this question. One is, what kind of results would trigger me to change therapy? And you could make the argument of the same parameters. So if at 3 months, somebody has a PCR greater than 10, or has by cytogenetics more than 35 cells with the Philadelphia chromosome, we know that those patients are unlikely to do well in the long term. And their outcome is pretty much identical, whatever they've been receiving up to that point. But the next part of the question is, what do I have that's going to improve their outcome? If you're treating it with imatinib, well, you have dasatinib and nilotinib that are probably better drugs and they can salvage patients. If I'm treating with dasatinib or nilotinib, I don't know that I have anything incredibly better. Patients who are truly resistant to, let's say, dasatinib, I think the chances of nilotinib working better than dasatinib are not very high. And the same is true if a patient is receiving nilotinib. I don't think that dasatinib offers a lot more. So it's a little bit problematic there, because we may not have something incredibly better. And the next question is, well, would you do a transplant in that patient? And transplant, no question, has the potential for cure, but let's not forget that there is this risk of mortality. It's getting better, but there's still a good 15-20% risk of mortality, whereas these patients are not going to die. The mortality at 5 years, it's still 2-5% at most. So that is a scenario that's not easily addressed nowadays. There is a drug in the way that's called ponatinib that's still experimental, that is working in the salvage setting in patients who have failed all the established drugs. And if that drug really makes it, then that may offer us a potential out for this dead end.
So just curious, how do you decide between nilotinib and dasatinib in a patient who's not going to be going on a trial?
As frontline therapy, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, as frontline therapy.
Well, the straight answer is there's really no good way to decide. I don't think we've used them extensively. And, you know, I've treated more than 100 patients frontline with each of them, and I cannot tell that one is better than the other. So some things that can help you sometimes are predicted side effects. If I have a patient, I just saw one in the clinic that has a history of a pancreatitis, well, I'm not going to use nilotinib, I'd prefer dasatinib. The schedule sometimes is something that the patients may guide your decision. Nilotinib is twice a day on an empty stomach, and for some patients, that's a difficult schedule, so that may be another way. But the reality is that for most patients, you have two great options, and it perhaps can be just your own experience and how you've seen these things in your patients.
Another question in terms of following patients, when do you do mutation analysis?
The mutation analysis is important when the patient has clearly developed clinical resistance. So clearly when a patient has lost a response, they had a good complete cytogenetic response and they lost their cytogenetic response, that patient needs a mutation analysis. A patient that has never achieved a complete cytogenetic response, let's say you've had 18 months of therapy and has not achieved a complete cytogenetic response, that patient needs a mutation analysis. A patient, for example, that just has not achieved a molecular response, I don't do mutation analysis on those patients because the yield is very, very low. If you have a patient with a complete cytogenetic response and still PCR positive or something like that, you're probably going to be doing 100 mutation analyses and are going to find at best one. So it's doing too much for very little return. So I don't do them in those settings.
So just to finish out on CML, you mentioned ponatinib, and maybe you can talk a little more about what we know about its efficacy, its side effects profile, but also bosutinib and omecetaxine.
Yeah, those three are interesting drugs because they may offer us additional tools to manage CML. So let me start with ponatinib. Ponatinib is a third-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor. The big difference between ponatinib and all the others is that it does inhibit the T315I mutation. So for one, it has that potential clinical role where we don't have any drugs today that can treat patients with this mutation. And in the studies that, and we presented this at ASCO, patients who have already developed resistance to imatinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib, still about 60% of patients respond to ponatinib. And in the patients that have the T315I, it's about 70% of patients who develop a good cytogenetic response. So very good potential in this setting. Toxicity profile, very well-tolerated drug. It does have some cutaneous toxicity, mostly dry skin, sometimes a rash. The dose-limiting toxicity is pancreatitis. At the doses that we're using in the phase 2 study, which is 45 milligrams, it's uncommon. Less than 10% of patients develop pancreatitis. So I think that it is manageable. So generally well-tolerated, similar to the other drugs that we have in this setting. The next drug is bosutinib. Bosutinib would be a second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor, meaning it's kind of like in the same league as dasatinib and nilotinib. It does not inhibit T315I, but the studies that have looked at treating patients who have failed prior therapy with imatinib have shown a good response rate, very similar to the other drugs. About 45 to 50% of patients achieved a complete cytogenetic response. And the toxicity profile, very favorable also. It causes perhaps more diarrhea than the other drugs, but it's usually a transient diarrhea, something that can be managed. Some liver toxicity that just needs monitoring. It also has been tested in patients who have failed the other drugs, imatinib and at least dasatinib or nilotinib, and about 30% of patients respond. So it definitely has some activity also in that setting. Omasataxin is interesting because it is not a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Omasataxin, you may recall homohorintonin that was used many years ago. That's when we were using interferon. Then we would use homohorintonin in patients who failed interferon. Well, omasataxin is just a semi-synthetic formulation of homohorintonin. And the mechanism of action is it inhibits protein synthesis, particularly of proteins that have a high turnover. And it has activity. This is a drug that's given subcutaneously, and it can work in about 25% of the patients, even when they failed everything else. Because it's not specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor, it works even when there is a T315I mutation. So it has that potential role. So it'll be a useful drug if it becomes available, because I do think that there is a subset of patients with CML that, despite the fact that they have BCR-ABL, you're going to need to go to something other than a tyrosine kinase inhibitor to try to get them into some level of response.
And what kind of side effects do you see?
With omasataxin, the main thing, it's a little more myelosuppressive than the other drugs. That's the main side effect. Other than that, not much, you know, a little of a reaction at the site of injection, minimal GI toxicity, really not much in terms of side effects.
So let's talk a little bit about myelofibrosis. And I want to begin by asking you to comment on the issue of accurate diagnosis of the disease, particularly separating out primary MF, post-PV MF, and post-ET MF. What are the issues there? What's the role of bone marrow biopsy and also JAK2 mutation testing for accurate diagnosis?
Yeah, that's an important point, because I do think that myelofibrosis is underdiagnosed. You may have a patient that just has some cytopenias, typically an older patient, and they may or may not have a big spleen. If it's very advanced, the disease, they will have a big spleen, but sometimes early on, they won't have. And I think many times we don't do the full diagnosis, but definitely in a setting like that that's persistent, the bone marrow, and it has to be a bone marrow biopsy, not only an aspirate, it is critical, because if you do establish that there is fibrosis, that's suggestive of one of these conditions. You do have to rule out other conditions where the myelofibrosis may be a secondary myelofibrosis. You know, you can develop myelofibrosis from infections, tuberculosis or something like that, for autoimmune diseases, for many other things. So you have to rule that out. But that is where the JAK2 mutation may be helpful. The presence of a clonal entity, which you can establish by detecting that the JAK2 is mutated, will make the diagnosis of myelofibrosis. It may be a little bit more tricky to establish whether this is a primary myelofibrosis or a post-polycythemia or post-ET myelofibrosis. If this is a patient that you're seeing in the clinic today for the very first time, already with myelofibrosis, you don't have much of a prior history, you may not know if there was a history there of ET or PV. Sometimes looking at the bone marrow may help you, may give you some features that suggest that it's evolving from that. But many other times, you just won't be able to make that diagnosis. But in practical terms, it probably doesn't make much of a difference, because nowadays you would probably treat them in a similar way.
So I know you have a lot of really great case scenarios, and I like to try to go through a few. But can you describe a case scenario that you think maybe would be, I'm not going to say likely, but that perhaps might be misdiagnosed?
Well, yes. I think this is more clearly in the earlier stages of myelofibrosis. A patient with a very established myelofibrosis, huge spleen, I think we're better there. But when there's the myelofibrosis at the early stages, when it's probably myelofibrosis grade 1, perhaps even only grade 2, where there's some dysplastic features in the bone marrow, you can occasionally see fibrosis in a patient with myelodysplastic syndrome, for example. So there may be a little bit of an overlap and difficulty in determining whether this is a myelodysplastic syndrome or a myelofibrosis. So those early patients with some fibrosis, I think it is critical to get a second opinion with a place that has a lot of experience with these cases to make sure that, you know, evidently if this is more of a myelodysplastic syndrome versus a myelofibrosis, the treatments we would use would be completely different.
So when you have a situation, because, you know, kind of now thinking about missing myelofibrosis nowadays is a little bit different implication than a few years ago. But is it usually because the bone marrow is not done or it's not interpreted correctly?
I think that we are getting better at doing the bone marrow because we now know a little bit more about the disease. The same applies to myelodysplastic syndrome. Some years ago, we perhaps, if we had the scenario that I described on an older patient with anemia, you know, low counts, whatever, for proper diagnosis, you know what you need to do, but you could also ask, and what am I going to do with that information? It's a painful procedure and whatever. So if I document the myelodysplastic syndrome, I'm still going to be doing the transfusions that I'm doing anyway. So what's the point? Now that we have better diagnostic tools and better treatments for these patients, I think then people, you know, the oncologist does recognize the benefit of making the diagnosis. So I think we're doing that. And I think that perhaps it's a difficulty in diagnosis in these borderline patients that are not clear cut. That's where we're missing some of them. And we're getting better, but we still can improve.
Can you talk a little bit about the challenges in using prognostic scales like IPSS and DIPSS? Also, the role of splenomegaly and global disease symptom burden in terms of assessing patients' condition, their prognosis, and eligibility for treatment?
Yeah, I think these are useful tools, like all these prognostic classifications on any disease. They're not perfect, but I think they are very useful because they can clearly identify patients that are more likely to have a very good long-term outcome versus patients that are not expected to have a good long-term outcome, and can guide your treatment decisions in an important way. For example, if you have a patient with myelofibrosis who's young, who may have the potential for a stem cell transplant, but they have a low risk by the DIPSS, well, you definitely wouldn't want to consider transplant because your expected survival is pretty good. But if it is a high risk, well, that's a patient where you start thinking about transplant right away. This is not a condition that where transplant is such a straightforward thing. So these classifications can help you with these definitions.
What are the key elements in these classifications?
It has to do with several factors. You know, there's the age, there's the symptoms, the constitutional symptoms that you mentioned, your counts, the white cell count, the blast count. So all of these come into the score, and then that gives you your final score and your definition. There is the DIPSS. The IPSS and the DIPSS are essentially the same thing. The D for the DIPSS is dynamic, meaning you can use it at any time during the course of therapy to still establish the treatment, but they include the same factors. Then there's what's called the DIPSS plus, which adds platelet count and, importantly, cytogenetics. And it does probably add a little bit of distinction in the different subsets, but cytogenetics are not easy, particularly in myelofibrosis when you may not be getting a good aspirate and all of that. So my favorite one is DIPSS. I think the DIPSS gives you a good classification. It helps you make good treatment decisions, and it's very easy to do in the clinic.
Let's talk a little bit about JAK inhibitor therapy. First, I want to ask you about your paper. I guess it's coming out in Blood, looking at a series of 107 patients with MF treated with ruxolitinib. Can you talk about what you're reporting there?
Yeah, this is an interesting exercise. We looked at our experience of patients that we've treated with these agents in early stages of the clinical trials. So these are all treated with ruxolitinib before it got approval, so all in clinical trials. And because all of these studies were single arm, one of the questions was, does the treatment with ruxolitinib impact the survival of these patients. We've heard enough about the improvement in the spleen size and improvement in the symptoms. The question is, do these patients live any longer than the patients that we treated before with supportive care or something like that? And what we found is that indeed we do see an improvement in survival compared to historical population. And for these purposes, we included a historical population, including a series of patients from Italy. So we collaborated with some of our colleagues in Italy to do this. And we do see a clear benefit in the survival. I think that's perhaps the most important message that we saw in this abstract. And then we analyzed some of the issues that come with the treatment of ruxolitinib, including how durable the responses may be and how long the patients may stay on therapy. In our experience, more than 50% of patients have been still receiving treatment with ruxolitinib more than 3 years after we started using these drugs. So most of the patients who respond can maintain their responses. This has been a little controversial. There's been other investigators that have reported that most patients end up coming off therapy by the third year. And we analyzed some of these differences between these reports in these manuscripts. In our experience, patients can really have a very sustained response for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, the number that jumps out to me at 3 years, I guess in the control group, 89% have discontinued therapy compared to less than half, 46% in your series.
That is correct. And some of these differences, if you look at the data, there's the discontinuation for adverse events is very low. And that was confirmed by the COMFORT-1 study, where the COMFORT-1 was ruxolitinib versus placebo. And the discontinuation for adverse events on that study was 11% in both arms, also in the placebo arm. So essentially it tells you that discontinuation for adverse events is as low as it can be, which is what we had in both groups of the manuscript that you're discussing. So I think a lot of that has to do with physicians' preferences and that kind of thing. Again, if you maintain patients and if you manage them well, we think that, yeah, more than 50% of patients can stay on therapy by 3 years.
Now I'm trying to recall the survival data, if there was any, in the COMFORT studies.
Yes, the COMFORT-1 study, in the last analysis that was presented of the COMFORT-1 study at ASCO this year, we did show that there is already a small but statistically significant survival benefit, which is remarkable because for a short follow-up that we have so far, that is very impressive, I think.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about what we know at this point about patient selection for using JAK inhibitor treatment, predictors of response and resistance, for example.
First, it's important to acknowledge what these drugs, at least from our knowledge today, what they can do and what we don't know yet that they can do. What we know they can do is improve the spleen size significantly and improve the symptoms. So clearly the patient that would be a good candidate for these drugs are the patients that have an enlarged spleen. Those are the patients who benefit the most. The question is, what about a patient that does not have an enlarged spleen? Well, if they have a lot of symptoms, we've analyzed some of our series of patients that in the COMFORT-1 study, everybody had to have an enlarged spleen, but in the early stages of the development, we did have a few patients that did not have an enlarged spleen or had a splenectomy, and they do benefit significantly on symptoms. So those are the things that are important. Predictors of response, in all of these studies, what we've seen is that you see equal responses in patients whether they have JAK2 mutations or not, which is important because about almost 50% of patients may not have the mutation, but they can respond equally well to ruxolitinib or to other JAK2 inhibitors for that matter. By the way, they're investigational, but there's others coming in the way. So this is an important observation. We are still trying to determine what are the predictors for loss of response, for resistance, and what are the mechanisms of resistance to the JAK2 inhibitors. That is not very clear at the moment. There's been some initial observation that there may be some new mutations that may develop that may prevent the activity of these JAK2 inhibitors. So perhaps we're going to find something like we have with the tyrosine kinase inhibitors in CML or the FLT3 inhibitors in AML, but that's still very early. The important thing is that a patient with early diagnosis myelofibrosis that has minimal symptoms, that has no spleen, that's a patient where we wouldn't treat with ruxolitinib because we do not know that it cures the disease, that it prevents the development of further fibrosis, or it reverses the myelofibrosis in patients where that's been very established. So in those settings, these drugs, we don't know that they offer any benefit.
Any sense that you have whether or not these agents are sort of affecting the underlying biology of the disease or more just cytokines and secondary effects?
That's a very good question. There are some reports that with some of these agents, you see a decline, allele burden. So you can measure, you know, how much of JAK2 mutated versus JAK2 wild type you have. And some studies have shown that there is a decline on the proportion of the JAK2 mutated clone. Now, we have to acknowledge that even though that sounds like a good thing, we don't really know that that means anything. We don't know that those patients are going to live any longer. We don't know that that's going to reverse the natural history of the disease. We don't know what the significance of that is. And interestingly enough, sometimes you see that there is a decline on the mutated clone by JAK2, but a persistence of a mutated clone by other mutations, for example, TET2 and other genes. So not very clear. There's also some reports with some of these inhibitors that we may see some reversal of the fibrosis. That would be huge, of course. It could be that it takes a long time before you see that. So you're not going to see that within a year or two. Maybe it takes 3 or 5 years before you see that. But these are early and not well-confirmed observations. So I would say that at this point, we don't know yet that these altered the biology of the disease. The symptom improvement is huge. The biology is still, there's indirect evidence and early exciting observations, but no clear evidence.
So what about other JAK inhibitors? I know you reported on TG101348 in the JCO last year, and at ASCO in the clinical trial session, you had a poster on the Jakarta study looking at SAR302503. I don't know, is that the same thing as the TG1?
That's correct. It's the same drug. It's just changed hands, but it's the same drug.
What do we know about this agent and other agents like it?
The SAR agent is interesting because it's another one that's finishing its pivotal trial comparing it to placebo, just like the COMFORT one. That's where the Jakarta trial is. And it's important because it may become the second JAK2 inhibitor that we have available in the clinic. Some of the differences is that this is more of a pure JAK2 inhibitor versus ruxolitinib, for example, which is a JAK1 versus JAK2. Now, whether that makes a difference in the outcome, we don't know. Because you see with the TG101 or with the SAR, you see improvement in the spleen, you see improvement in the symptoms, just like you do with the ruxolitinib. So, you know, potentially the difference in inhibiting JAK1, at least from that perspective, it may not have a major role. It's well tolerated. It has perhaps a little bit more GI toxicity than you see with ruxolitinib, which essentially has no GI toxicity, but generally well tolerated. So it is an important drug, and again, we may have it available very soon.
Any comments on the issue of monitoring patients with myelofibrosis, both clinically and laboratory-wise, who are receiving these kinds of targeted therapies? Any sort of, you know, pearls you have or suggestions in terms of how to do this?
When these patients receive treatment, it's obviously very important. One of the adverse events that all these drugs have, which is an on-target effect, is myelosuppression. So we need to be careful to monitor the counts closely, particularly at the beginning. Some of these patients will develop thrombocytopenia or worsening anemia, and you're going to need to sometimes hold therapy and adjust doses. We don't want to do it for just minimal changes, but if it gets to be severe, then you do need to take some action. We also routinely check for liver toxicities and things like that, but there's very little of that we see. I think it is good practice to follow with bone marrow biopsies, but you don't have to do them very frequently. I would do one, if not on a clinical trial, you know, after a year on treatment and make sure that there's no changes. Very important, if you see sudden changes in the counts, always do a bone marrow because, remember, these patients can transform to an acute leukemia and you want to detect that when it's happening. So a patient who's, you know, all of a sudden his pattern of anemia changes dramatically or the platelets change more than you expect, that's important. I don't think that at this point this issue about measuring sequentially the allele burden can be recommended or required for clinical practice. I still think that's a research question, very important, and we'll continue doing those studies. But I don't see a real value for just the general practice, general management of a patient in real life.
So looking at the case scenarios that you suggested we talk about here, let's start out with CML. Patients getting therapy with imatinib standard dose, 3 months, only has a minor cytogenetic response, BCR-ABL transcript 26%, tolerating imatinib well. What do you do?
Well, you know, this is a very common scenario now because we've seen all these data coming out more and more that if you have a PCR of more than 10 or you don't have a partial cytogenetic response at 3 months, that these patients don't do very well. So it makes you think that you probably should change therapy. One of the things that we've analyzed recently is, do you need to change at 3 months or can you still wait another 3 months and see what happens? So this is data that I just recently analyzed from our experience. And what we found is that if at 3 months you're bad, you don't have the good responses, I'm going to call those bad. If you then wait and see how they are at 6 months, so some of these patients will continue being bad, but some of them by 6 months have caught up. They've already achieved a good response. The patients who catch up, their long-term outcome is as good as the patients who were good already at 3 months. So what that suggests is that perhaps at 3 months is a little too early. It's only one time point. It's too early. And you can perhaps wait for 6 months. Very important to make sure that you get that 6 months. And if the patient still is falling behind, that's the patient that you need to change therapy. Otherwise, you can continue the treatment that you're doing.
So the other CML scenario, I'm guessing, is not very common, but patient who chronic phase CML received treatment with imatinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib has not achieved any or minor cytogenetic response at best, despite tolerating treatment well. What do you do? Ponatinib, and do you change what you do based on whether or not they have a T3151 mutation?
Yeah, so that's an interesting scenario. As you said, it's not common, but perhaps in referral institutions, that's more and more what we're seeing because that's where you get stuck and what do you do? And ponatinib works in this scenario. The response rate is good, but interestingly enough, when you look at the data with ponatinib, the patients who respond the best are the patients that have T315I. Then the patients that have a mutation other than T315I. And the response rate in patients that do not have any mutations is the lowest. Still some response, but it's clearly the lowest. So that suggests that perhaps there's a subset of patients where inhibition of the tyrosine kinase is not going to get you anywhere, that you're going to need some other way of killing the leukemia cells. That's where perhaps a drug like omacetaxin may be useful if it gets to be approved, because you're going to have to attack these cells from a different angle if you're going to have a chance to cure them. Evidently, these may be cells that have learned how to live, even if you block their survival mechanism by BCR-ABL.
So a couple MF scenarios. Patient with myelofibrosis is started on treatment with ruxolitinib. Initial improvement in symptoms and decrease in spleen size from 18 centimeters down to 2. But now the spleen's getting bigger. 6 centimeter, patient still feels well. What do you do?
And that's an important one, and it's something that I see with some frequency. And it may explain the big difference between reports that say that 90% of patients eventually discontinue and those that say that, you know, less than 50% eventually discontinue. My take on a patient like this is that this patient is still having benefit. It's lost response compared to the best response that the patient had. The spleen was 2 and is now 6. But it's still better than it was at the beginning. The patient is feeling very well. They're still eating good, no symptoms, etc. To me, this patient needs to continue therapy. And what I see in these patients is that sometimes you see a little bit of a fluctuation in the spleen size. Some of that may be our measurements, because measuring below the costal margin is prone to a lot of variability. Some of that may be true variability in the measures of the spleen. But this is a patient that, in my opinion, has to stay on therapy. As long as the patient's still feeling good and the spleen is within an acceptable level, I don't change these patients on therapy. To me, these patients still having a good response, having benefit from the drug. And in addition, I don't know anything better to give to these patients.
Okay, another MF scenario. Patient's got a 24 centimeter spleen, hemoglobin 9.5, a platelet count of 64,000. Can you use ruxolitinib?
And that's important because the original studies, like the Comfort 1, was limited to patients that had a platelet count of above 100. And there's actually a recommendation for a titration of the dose depending on the platelet count. If you have more than 200,000, you use 20 twice a day. If you have 100 to 200,000, you use 15 twice a day. Now, the label doesn't say that you shouldn't use it on patients with less than 100, but there's very little data on this. Now, there is a study that's ongoing. It was presented earlier this year on patients that have platelets between 50 and 100. And what you do there is you start with a lower dose of ruxolitinib. We've started with doses of 5 milligrams twice a day and little by little escalate as tolerated by the patient. And what we've seen is that patients really can tolerate it well. They can benefit as much as patients that have a higher platelet count. And what I've seen anecdotally, but in some of my patients, is that actually over time you may see that the platelets improve little by little. So I would definitely use ruxolitinib on this patient. I would carefully monitor the platelets, but I think it is a patient that could still have benefit with this drug.
Okay, why don't we try an ALL scenario? Younger patient with ALL who's treated initially with HCVAD, responds, but relapse after only 3 months. Now what?
Well, this is a tough patient because if it relapses so quickly after chemotherapy, really variations of chemotherapy are unlikely to help you. You can see if there's any chemotherapy drug that you have not used. This regimen, the hypercivat, for example, does not have asparaginase early on, and asparaginase is a good drug. So you could put them on an asparaginase-based regimen. There's a regimen called MOAD that I like a lot for salvage. But this is a patient that will be ideal candidate for a monoclonal antibody, either the blinatumomab or for the inotuzumab or zogamycin. Of course, today we only have them in clinical trials, so you know not everybody can go to a clinical trial. But if you have that option, I would definitely seek that. If not, I think that a regimen that incorporates asparaginase early on, perhaps that will be my first choice.
Okay, finally, let's just take a quick AML. We haven't talked much about that today, but patient with AML, FLT3, ITD, who gets treated with 3 plus 7, has no response, gets two cycles of high-dose Ara-C, no response. Now what?
So these patients are important because now we're starting to see all these drugs that are FLT3 inhibitors that really have a clear benefit for these patients. None of them are approved as FLT3 inhibitors, but sorafenib is available not as a FLT3 inhibitor, but it is a great FLT3 inhibitor. And definitely what I would like to do on this patient is give them a treatment based on a FLT3 inhibitor. As single agents, the responses that you see are very impressive, but very short-lived. Many times, that's enough to get the patient to the transplant. So if I could give this patient, for example, sorafenib or one of the investigational drugs, bring the blasts down and take them to transplant right away, that'll be ideal. We are also looking at combinations of these agents with some other standard chemotherapy or something to try to get the responses to be more durable for the patient who will not be able to go to transplant. But I would definitely try to get to a FLT3 inhibitor on these patients.
And in terms of sorafenib, if you can get it, same dose and schedule with HCC and renal cell or different?
Nope, same schedule, 400 milligrams twice a day, that's what we use.